Hey everyone, welcome to Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick, historian by day, music lover by night, and on the fourth Wednesday of every month, host of this show, which brings those two worlds together, putting music in its historical context, asking what is going on in the world when music hits listeners' ears and how that shapes what that music means to us down through time. I have got a far-out show for you today. I'm very excited. We are going to be returning to 1967 to explore the world of the 13th Floor Elevators by looking at their second full-length album, Easter Everywhere, arguably one of the defining albums of psychedelic rock, even though its impact at the time wasn't much. So to help us do that, I've got an interview with one of the world's foremost scholars, really, of the 13th Floor Elevators, Paul Drummond. But first, it's no mistake today that I'm talking to you about the 13th Floor Elevators, a band that shrouded themselves in mysterious spiritual imagery, including the many meanings of the number 13. And that's because we are celebrating this station, WGXC's 13th birthday, with a lucky 13 pledge drive. And we are asking for your support to help keep these airwaves creative, weird, and informative, how Rocky Erickson and the Elevators would have wanted them. So as you're listening to this episode, as you're taking this trip, can I ask you to donate? Even better, maybe make a monthly donation. Our goal is to hit $5,000 in monthly support. That will allow us to end traditional pledge drives as we know them and to focus on making WGXC even more exceptional. There's some great perks, some merch items, some thank you gifts for monthly supporters. You can check it all out and make a donation at wavefarm.org/donate. Thanks so much for your support. And now, on to the show. When you think of the summer of love, that moment in 1967 when psychedelic rock and free love rose to the surface of American culture, particularly in San Francisco, what are the albums that come to mind? Maybe it's Sgt. Pepper by the Beatles, Cream's Disraeli Gears, Their Satanic Majesty's Request by the Rolling Stones, Strange Days by the Doors, Jefferson Airplane. Unless you're someone really in the know, there's probably an album missing from your list. And it's not just any album. It's possibly the most important psychedelic rock album ever made. And you're not the only one missing it. In fact, when it came out late in 1967, it was hardly noticed. Badly distributed by the record label. In effect, it missed its moment. The album is Easter Everywhere by a band called the 13th Floor Elevators. Who were the 13th Floor Elevators? They were a rock band formed in Austin, Texas in the mid-1960s, fronted by three principal members, Rocky Erickson, the band's iconic vocalist, guitarist Stacy Sutherland, and the band's visionary lyricist, spiritual force, and electric jug player, Tommy Hall. Driven by incredible musicianship that fused R&B with pop and the rawness of garage rock, the band experimented profusely with mind-altering substances, turning out lyrical content that pointed to unseen, mysterious universes within the mind and soul. The result was something otherworldly, a captivating, almost religious version of rock and roll that turned out huge crowds throughout Texas in 1966. There was a name for it, psychedelic rock, a name that the band itself coined on their business card that year. It was also in 1966 that the band put out their first studio album, The Psychedelic Sounds of the 13th Floor Elevators, on International Artists, a Houston-based record label. In early 1967, the band returned to the studio to record the follow-up, Easter Everywhere, which would go on to become their masterpiece, both in terms of musicianship, as well as the vivid presentation of Tommy Hall's sprawling belief system. Only, it wasn't seen that way at the time. In fact, when the album came out, you could hardly find it on record store shelves, and the Elevators' journey was to be short-lived. The band would go on to record only one more album before breaking up in 1968. Persistent troubles with law enforcement and authorities in Texas relating to the band's drug use, as well as their sometimes blasphemous spiritual claims, confined them largely to the Lone Star State during what should have been the height of their American and perhaps even international success. The album has lived many lives since then, however. And to help explain why Easter Everywhere and the 13th floor elevators have attracted so much of a cult following through the years, I set out to interview Paul Drummond, author of several books about the band, who will take us inside the world that they created in 1967. But first, here's the lead track off of Easter Everywhere, Slip Inside This House. This is Music in Time on WGXC. That was Slip Inside This House, the first track off of the 13th Floor Elevators' Easter Everywhere from 1967, the album we're discussing today. That was a single version of that song, shortened from the 7-minute version that opens the album. Bedouin tribes ascending from the egg into the flower. Those are the lyrics that open that song, giving you just the most inviting taste of what you're in store for on this album and what the elevators were up to when they were making it. To help me dig even further into that subject, I sat for an interview conversation with Paul Drummond. Paul Drummond is an antiquarian bookseller and author, among other things. He runs a shop called Pleasures of Past Times, originally started by his father, David Drummond, and which used to stand in Cecil Court in London's West End, now continues online. And germane to our purposes today, Paul is author of two books on the 13th floor elevators. The first, I Mind, The Saga of Rocky Erickson and the 13th Floor Elevators, The Pioneers of Psychedelic Sound from 2007, and the second, 13th Floor Elevators, A Visual History, 2020. As you'll hear in the interview, this just scratches the surface of Paul's historical, really archaeological work on the elevators and their world. There's really no one better to help us reach back through time to 1967 and the release of Easter Everywhere. And I'm thrilled to have him. So let's get to the interview. I want to start with your story, actually. I want to hear how you came to be initiated in the 13th Floor Elevators music. You've written two books about them now. A lot of your intellectual focus has been on this band. How did it start for you?
Well, I'm a little bit too young for punk, but that was what was going on when I was growing up. And my two favorite punk albums are the Sex Pistols and X-Ray Specs, and I pretty much thought the rest of it was utter garbage, and I still do. So I'd never really occurred to me to listen to old music, and I got given the Beatles 62 to 66, otherwise known as the Red Album. And that's a very interesting progression, because you go from Love Me Do to Paperback Writer, and you could see this transition in music and this development just in this four sides of an album. So Paperback Writer really interested me, and I figured from that 65 was the year that music changed. So then I also realized that when you've got these like trite albums by the Rolling Stones, like Between the Buttons in mono, it sounded very pretty in English. If you pick up the American enhanced stereo version, they sound like garage. So you can see how those British bands started garage rock, and that's obviously very influential in the Elevators. So when I started discovering bands like Sonics and all of that, and then a lot of the bands I realized were Texas, so I really like that Texas sound. And then when I found the Elevators, everyone said, that's your favorite album, and I was going, no it's not. And they went, no, haven't you realized? And then years later I met Julian Cope, who's lead singer with the Teardrop Explodes, and that was his favorite band, so we got chatting, and he started writing music books. So he said, you know, I've never actually written a research book. So I'd done all the research. One day he just looked at me and went, don't you realize you're writing this book? And I went, no. And that's when I kind of went off to Texas to actually realize that I'd got a sewing machine, and I'd bound together on this industrial sewing machine all of these papers, turned up in Texas, and like all the guys were kind of like, oh my God, this guy's actually done the homework. So I was sort of showing them the posters and what happened at this gig. So that's how I kind of got initiated into the Elevators. Was really, yes, I love the music, but there was obviously this story behind the music that had never been told. And I trained as a theatre designer, so I'd always liked Arto and the Theatre of Cruelty, and this whole idea of manifesto for a theatre that's bound to fail. So the Elevators gave me everything, like with Arto, it's like madness, it's creativity from madness, drug-induced, and then divinity. So you've got these three things going on, and it was just too interesting not to go and explore, really.
What year was it that you showed up in Austin?
It would have been about Easter of 1999, I think, when I first went out.
And what was the, how much of the world that the 13th Floor Elevators had created was still kind of there in the city? What did you find when you set foot there?
I was very disappointed, you know. I didn't exactly think there'd be pyramids, you know, full of information or anything, but everyone was going to take me down to the Guadalupe to see the Stevie Ray Vaughan. I was like, Steve, are you who? Sculpture? I mean, what? And I was like, look, I'm from Britain. The only two people we've heard from Texas are Buddy Holly, Janis Joplin, and then the Elevators. I just really didn't care, and I was really disappointed. So it wasn't until I kind of went out to Kerrville in the Hill Country and started meeting John Eyck, the drummer, and then Ronnie, and then really the story, when I got to Kerrville, that's where you really start picking up the story. And I met Stacey Sutherland, the lead guitarist's mother, Sybil, who liked me. And she kind of said, I always knew someone would walk through this door asking the right questions. So she put me in this pickup truck and drove me up to the top of the hill to the cabin, a piece of which I have here in my hand, which is now burnt. The next time I went there, it was like about 20 years later, and the cabin had been burnt down. So I got the charred remains, as the lyric goes. But she took me up to the cabin, to the hunting cabin, and that's when I really started to understand the landscape that the elevators had come from, and the whole outlaw status and sitting on top of this hill. They'd instigated psychedelia. They'd come up with this word, psychedelic rock, while tripping, well, Tommy Hall did, tripping and watching the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. And he figured out you couldn't have psychedelic, you know, Latin music, psychedelic classical, it had to be psychedelic rock. And rock being this very plastic medium that kids will play and play and play. So if you've got a message, it's brilliant. They voluntarily, they pay money, and the message just gets repeated. So that was why pop was a plastic medium for his message.
That's exactly the point I wanted to go to as we start to think about Easter Everywhere, which is that moment in time. So the early months of 1967, maybe before the band goes to record the album, kind of what's the status of psychedelic rock? It's something the band had kind of staked a claim to, but who were there? You know, who else was in that cohort? What did that scene look like at the time?
They'd obviously, they'd released, they'd gone out to San Francisco in August of 66 on probation, without going into too much detail there. So they were only allowed to be out there for like, I think it's 2-3 months. So they had to come back. So just as everyone else is caught on, they returned to Texas and they couldn't leave. So they instigate psychedelia with increasingly big shows in Texas, staging those. And then they're waiting for an East Coast tour to promote psychedelic sounds. It never happens because the record company get cold feet. So by Easter of 67, they're kind of washed up. That Ronnie and John Ike, the original rhythm section, have left because they think the band's going nowhere. But Tommy Hall and Rocky Erickson are living together in this apartment on East 6th Street, which is no longer there. And Tommy starts writing what becomes Easter Everywhere at Easter. And he's reading all these books like Secret from the Golden Flower, which is a 18th century Chinese text. He's reading Yogananda's autobiography of Yogi and some other sort of texts around that kind of, and Mukherjee's Tantra Art, which explains Kundalini and all those kind of things. So, you know, he's not one of these people who ever went on the hippie trail. He never left the United States, other than to go south of the border to Mexico to score peyote. But he's absorbing these texts and taking an awful lot of acid. So that's the genesis of it. He's actually at Easter of 67 in Austin, Texas. But then they go out and they hide in the hill country at the cabin that I just mentioned. And because they put the sleeve note on the end of Psychedelic Sounds about redefining God, they're in trouble with the Kerrville City Council. So they really are being run ragged by the law. But they're on this hilltop, it's about 18 cattle grids, so the police just can't get to them. And even if they do, they're off the other side of the hill. So they kind of are living like that. But yeah, they'd annoyed people. So you've got the band that started, coined the term, they're sitting on a hilltop. While Beatles are doing whatever they're doing, they're basically rehearsing a new rhythm section, completely missed the Summer of Love. They've got nothing to do with it. And then in August, they kind of roll off the mountain, go to Houston for a month to record Easter Everywhere. So they're quite removed from anything else that's going on.
It's really interesting the way you were describing Tommy's kind of lens into spirituality. It seems like something so personal.
I don't think later on, by 68, after Easter Everywhere, he does become literally a card-carrying Christian, and he demanded now before shows to lecture his ideas, which we won't probably go into, but you know, the cops have been literally like, what did that boy say? You know, and it's in the Bible Belt. And Stacey, again, was petrified. I think Stacey was always in a high state of anxiety. But Stacey was very religious. I think Tommy just read a lot of books and he could bolt it together. And the religious sources he's taking, he's bolting them on. So you've got to think he's a mathematician. He just comes from a science background. So a lot of these ideas, what he's really trying to do is come up with a mathematic model for spatial causation, so singularity, what we understand as Big Bang in the West. But he's finding in these esoteric texts, the one I mentioned earlier, that they all describe basically the creationist theory is from a single point in time. So you've got this idea of the expanding universe. You'll find that in Hindu, Vedas, and you'll find it, you know, so it's the same idea. So he's correlating the very, very ancient with modern science. And that's really the essence of what he's going on about.
I don't want to ask you to pick favorites, but as we're talking about the spirituality, the spiritual aspect of the band, is there a song or a couple of songs on this album that kind of stand out to you as really clear lenses into the way the band approached that aspect of the music?
Absolutely. I mean, obviously Slip Inside This House. And once you start writing about that, you really go down the rabbit hole. The last track, Postures, Leave Your Body Behind, that's the song that no one really, I think it's no one's favourite on that album, but it's the most important one. And if you really want to understand the full, what the Elevator's about, and there's a key line in that that he told me I'm not allowed to explain, which I will do in the book, but yeah, that's the whole key point to the Elevator. So that is the key song, is Postures.
Welcome back to Music in Time on WGXC. If you're just joining us, we are going deep on the inner and outer worlds of the 13th Floor Elevators and their 1967 release, Easter Everywhere. That was Postures, Leave Your Body Behind. On this little trip, we are guided by an interview I recorded with Paul Drummond, an author who has written some of the most searching and informative materials on the Elevators. Before I get back to that interview, let me remind you why we're talking about the 13th Floor Elevators today. That's because WGXC, this station, is celebrating a very important birthday this month. It's 13th. And in honor of that birthday, we're asking for your support. Are you digging this show? Do you dig other shows like it that are creative, experimental, informative? Well, that kind of radio can only survive if people like you put up to support it. So donate. Go to wavefarm.org/donate. Consider becoming a monthly donor at any level that fits you. You'll be part of this amazing community, and we've even got some perks, some shirts, some totes, and whatnot to support donations at $20 and above as monthly supporters. So thanks for that, folks. And with that, it's back to my interview with Paul Drummond as we pick up the conversation exploring how the spiritual world of Easter Everywhere connected to the realities of America and Texas in 1967. It seems so contradictory that this mind-expanding, you know, psychedelic frontier band comes out of one of the most culturally conservative states in the United States, Texas. Obviously, there's a counterculture kind of built into Austin and Houston to a lesser extent. But I just wonder how you reflect on this. Like, how did Texas imprint the band and maybe vice versa? Like, is this a band you could imagine coming out of any other place in the
Absolutely not. No, this is the thing, is if you haven't been to Texas and you don't know Texas, it's completely a different, I'm going to say animal because I'm quoting someone saying that, but it's a completely different animal to anything that anyone realizes. And the University of Texas scene around that time, I mean, you've got Chet Helms there, who's coming down from California. He's a student. You've got Gilbert Shelton, the Freak Brothers, running the Humor magazine, the Texas Ranger, Janis Joplin enrolls there. And, you know, Tommy Hall comes in, and he's from a military family. He joins the army. He's very straight, but he sees all these bohemians are all like, well, Powell St. John is the most important out of all of them, who's the songwriter on the for the Elevators. He's the most important because he's the guy who who's the Keyesian between everyone. And he's the guy from Laredo, Texas, on the border with Mexico. So there's the cactus farms down there where they're getting the peyote from. So he's the one who turns Tommy onto that. And Tommy's considered uncool, but he wants to become part of this bohemian elite. And really the elevators evolve out there. And then people like Rocky Erickson and Benny Thurman, all these people are periphery to that. And Stacy and John Ike coming in from the Hill Country to school weed from Gilbert Shelton, apparently. So, you know, the University of Texas, that unique scene, and if it hadn't been in that sort of protest movement where people are starting to... So really, without the UT scene, you probably wouldn't have got the elevators because Tommy wouldn't have gone to university. And then really only because the elevators were bust, it's like, would a San Francisco actually have happened in Austin, Texas? You know, Texas, you know, got this reputation now, music capital of the world. But there's this massive what if the elevators hadn't been made an example of by the authorities, well, maybe San Francisco would have happened because all the talent went from Austin. You know, Chet Helms went back to the elevators bust in January 67. Everyone flees. And everyone has to, and the elevators have to wait 6 months because for their court case to come up, so they can get the probation set to San Francisco because they don't want you to repeat offend in the locale you were caught in. So, I mean, it's a joke that they go there. But, I mean, what if, you know, would San Francisco have happened in the 60s or would it be in Austin, Texas?
Let's, for the purposes of talking about Easter Everywhere, take us back to when the record actually came out in 1967. Who's buying this record? What's the kind of exposure that the band had? What does this album do to people who are listening to the 13th Floor Elevators or are new to the band?
I don't think anyone did. I think that's why they're so goddamn expensive now. I mean, I was just looking up the other day. A Clean Psychedelic Sounds went for $4,500. Easter Everywhere is about $4,000 for a mono copy, of which there were maybe only 100. It didn't get out. I mean, there was a couple of signings in Houston record shops. There's one at, it just didn't sell. But Easter Everywhere is the rare one. You know, the warehouses, even in the late 80s, the warehouses full of sealed copies of all the other IA albums, but not Easter Everywhere. It just did not sell. And I don't think it got distributed. But that's the one that you just couldn't find. You just couldn't find it. When I was growing up, I just could not find a copy just to listen to, and I'd read all about it. I pretended that I knew everything on it. But when you finally heard it, it's like, wow, okay, so this is what this sounds like. And, I remember that there was a guy called Bill Allison who ran a famous record shop in the Portobello Road called Plastic Passion. I remember literally I was like 17 and got clutching this Italian bootleg, and he kind of stood in front of the door and gave me this frightening lecture of, do you know what you're leaving the shop with? And I was like, how did I know that, you know, he gave me this lecture, but how did I know this is going to inform my life for the rest, you know, rest of my life, you know? But yeah, it's like joining a cult, you know, can I talk to you about the 13th floor elevators, you know?
Why do you think it didn't sell?
It wasn't distributed. Yeah. The record company had already got cold feet by then. They didn't know what to do. You know, they hadn't promoted the first one. It's like, go back in the studio and record the next one. Why do you think they put out stupid Elevators Live, which was material just overdubbed with a bullfight or whatever it was from San Antonio? They just put out more product, panicked. They didn't know what they were doing. So they had a very dysfunctional record label that they couldn't escape from the contract. But Tommy used all of that to his advantage because he knew they were kind of doomed. Goes back to the Arto manifesto for theatre bound to fail, is that he knew that actually by staying with a record company that didn't know what they were doing, he'd have control of the sleeve art, the contents, there would be no editing. If they'd gone for a major label, we would not have Easter Everywhere. So he kind of knew that it looks like a package put out by a religious cult, and that's kind of what it is, you know.
So imagery plays a huge role in this, and you, of course, yeah, authored a visual history. Talk to me a little bit about the visuals on Easter Everywhere and in this kind of order of beliefs that Tommy in particular was creating. What's the significance of the cover and the packaging?
Absolutely. That is that an album cover is a square. That's the material world. George Banks was saying that if you pick, of course everyone picks up an album cover and sticks it on their forehead. Of course everyone goes around that, but the band name depicted as Buddha's flaming eyebrows is the crescent moon of the mother goddess. It's the third eye. It's all of those things in one. And then you've got the blazing primordial sun above that, which is again third eye. And then Easter everywhere is sort of nirvana at the top of your skull. So you've got that on the back. You've got the meditating yogi, which is the kundalini with the nadi lines either side. So that relates to Yogananda, the idea of kundalini, Kriya yoga, the breathing exercises. He wasn't practicing any of these because they weren't actually, taught in America at that time, but he'd read all about them. So that he's a very early instigator of those ideas. Then you take the LP out and it's in a lyric in a bag. So you've got the actual information there, the words. Then you take out the record, which is a circle, the divine symbol of the divine, the circle. You put the needle in the groove, the needle travels down a spiral that's ever tighter to the center. And in those days, it's designed around the fact that records had an auto replay function. So each side, the five songs, are designed to be cyclical, so that they're on cycle, endless. And the idea is that when you're tripping, you just never turn the record over. And again, it goes back to pop being this plastic medium, that the songs are constantly reinforced by this cycle of playing each side. And you've got the whole birth, and it's five songs. You've got birth, death, you've got, the five stages of the cycle of life on either side. How anyone was meant to determine this without meeting them or having explained to them, I don't know. But it's very interesting. Well, I'm talking about the cyclical thing on each side. Originally, dust, obviously, we're all returned to dust, cosmic space dust, or whatever, was going to be the last song on side one. But he changed it to "It's All Over Now, Baby Blue," which again, I don't think people get the sense of humour on that. I know they call it Baby Blue, but it's all over now. I mean, it's a joke.
Yonder stands your orphan.
This is Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick, and I'm talking today to Paul Drummond, an antiquarian bookseller and author of multiple books on the 13th floor elevators. We're discussing Easter Everywhere, the band's masterpiece from 1967, which ironically didn't make much of an impact at the time, but which has grown in terms of its cultural import and its wider following throughout the years. That is in no small part thanks to Paul himself and people like him. Paul's own life's work has, as he put it to me in the interview, really become the 13th floor elevators. I talked to him about that, about how the band has found resonance at certain moments for other musicians and for the wider public, and how that interest has shaped his own life down to the present in this portion of our interview. How do you think about this album in particular, Easter Everywhere, in the short span of the 13th floor elevators? Kind of how do you look back on this album and its importance in the catalog?
Well, it's the middle one. I mean, you've got a beginning, middle, and end, and Bull of the Woods is very different, definitely the end. So the middle one is always the best in a way. I mean, I love the first album. Well, I love all three of them, but the first one, it depends what mood you're in, but I think undeniably Easter Everywhere is the best one. I'll go further and say it's the best psychedelic album of all time. It's just, I just cannot be bothered with anything else. I mean, forget the Grateful Dead, forget everything is all utter garbage to me now. So I've gone so heavily into the elevators that I just pretty much only like the 30, I mean, you know, I really have got into it that much. Just everything else sounds garbage in comparison to this. It's just, and if you don't get it, you don't get it. But once you hear that kind of like hi-hat, repetitive, like a metronomic, you're like a drip on Slip Inside's House, boof, you're there. It's something very powerful about it that once you get it, and I've had friends, you know, who really, really didn't like the elevators. And then when they got it, they're like, okay, yeah, I've convinced a few people. It's something very strange about this music. There's a quote from a guy, John David Bartlett, whose record I'm doing, who was around the recording of, he met Tommy in summer 67, and he just said, Tommy Hall crawled inside my brain in the summer of 67, and he's been there ever since. And I feel exactly the same way. If I hadn't have listened to that album, picked up, had that lecture in the record shop I told you about by Bill Ellerton, who sadly died last year, which is why we've dedicated this new version to him. But it's this lecture of people who have discovered this music before you, and you get this lecture about it. And it's slightly creepy, it's slightly frightening, and you're like, wow, what am I getting into? But without that, I mean, blimey, I don't know what I'd be doing. You know, I mean, my job is literally the 13th floor elevators now.
Yeah, it's musical archaeology. It's incredible, yeah. And it's work you've now been involved in for more than two decades.
Yeah, I mean, they're bigger now. They're probably selling more records now than they ever did historically. And this is to the amazement of the band, not only that some British guy turns up telling them what day of the week they played a certain gig on and blah, which Ronnie Leatherman finds absolutely hilarious, the bass player, and I'm also putting out his solo album. So he's coming over to Britain for the first time. We're doing shows in sort of Paris and to launch his solo album alongside these three. So, you know, he's able to do that now. It's really sweet, and I think it's very, you know, it's very good for them to just realise that how much these, and particularly for Tommy Hall, that his ideas have expanded out. And there's this whole generation where, you mentioned earlier, we were talking earlier about how I'm also an antiquarian bookseller. I had a bookshop in London, still online. But I got a very fatalistic view about, I don't like this word nostalgia, and I think a lot of the past will die off because of the lack of, you know, there's a new generation that isn't nostalgic for this. So if something is not good, vital, important, and has some sort of intensity that grabs people, it will die away, you know. Who wants to listen to a Herman's Hermit record now? Play the 13th floor elevators. Even if people hate rock music, which a lot of people do, they can't deny there's something weird going on with this. So I think the elevators will live on. Just look at the album covers. You're going to want to find out what's inside of those. They're just weird. I mean, you know, all three of them are weird.
Yeah.
It's just, how can you not want to watch the inside, you know?
Somebody who's written about and been thinking about the 13th floor elevators for so long, do you see any logic as to kind of
what are the moments, or are there moments when culturally their music or the ideas behind it have, you know, a lot of purchase, or there's a reason for people kind of turning to their music or discovering it?
Well, it seems to be, it is cyclical. It's every few years. Like, so the first people I know, so in Britain, were was Bill Allerton, who I mentioned, this, who this new version of East River is dedicated to, because he was one of the first in 1970. He was proselytizing here. Another one is the music writer John Savage, who wrote the foreword for the last book, who described how strange it was going to Dobell's, which is in the Charing Cross Road in London, jazz, but you could get jazz record shop, but you could get American imports, and just finding Easter everywhere in the racks there in 1972, which is the kind of start of the whole kind of rock and roll revival here. And just it struck me how strange that was. And then obviously during punk, it was very relevant because of the rawness of it. And then, you know, when I was sort of growing up in the mid 80s, you had people like Julian Cope covering I've Got Levitation. It just seemed that every few years there was some wave, and they seemed to be like, well, the Elevators were musicians, this sort of esoteric band that everyone who was cool was referencing them. Then you've got Primal Scream doing Slip Inside This House. So it's every few, I don't think they've ever been, they've been lurking under the surface.
To prove Paul's point, here's Primal Scream's incredible cover of Slip Inside This House off of 1991's Screamadelica. We'll be right back.
Crazy. And actually, to that point, can you explain what you're working on now? Because I think this is, you know, in terms of the cycles of interest or nostalgia for the 13th floor elevators, it sounds like there might be another one coming. So what is it you're working on now?
So Charlie Records in, it's a French run record label in London. They own the rights to the music. They got it from, acquired it from Leland Rogers in the 90s. And when the first book, I Mine, came out in 2007, they kind of phoned me up and said, hey, can we do a 2 CD? And I told them where to go. I then went back to them and went, ooh, right, you've kind of relocated this music to the bargain bin. Can I do a box set? And Jean-Luc Young, who was the owner, met with him and he said, yeah, let him do it. I like his idea. So that's how I got the funding to do the box set. And then that was, you know, I left it for 10 years. And then about 3 years ago, he turned up again and said, would you do it again? Would you do the IA label and reissue everything? So I've been consulting. I don't work for them, but I'm a consultant there. So I've been consulting to do these. And yeah, they've let me do these half-speed masters. So I'm calling it, it's so ridiculous, I'm calling it the Quest for Pure Sanity, which is quite off the back of the first album, because it's driving me insane, I should say. But I've been doing it so long, so we're really going into meticulous detail to do these records, and it'll be 13 of them. So we did a best of. They said, can you do a best of? And I said, no. And then I thought about it, went, only if it can be a sampler for this new project, The Quest for Pure Sanity. So there's a, came out last year, called 13 of the Best. And I justify all of the songs on there in terms of relating to what 13 means. It's like 13 meanings. Those are now expanded out into a series of 13. They'll come out of order, but there's 13 of them that'll take you. It'll be everything they've ever played will go into some form of project. So you get the normal album, then you get expanded box sets. So like No Moaning, every kind of version of everything will come out. If you don't like it, don't buy it, but you know, everything will come out eventually. So, you know, you can just buy the nice single album, Half Speed Mastered. Sounds wonderful. Sounds better than the original. That's the other thing with being AB. It actually sounds better than the original pressing. So much technology has moved on since I last did this. And then if you want to hear every last version, there'll be a box set for that. So it's taking a lot of work, but I'm a year into that already.
Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us on Music and Time today. This is a fascinating conversation, just scratching the surface on this world of the 13th floor elevators.
You're welcome. That's a lot of fun. Thank you very much. Good luck.
Thanks,
with it all.
Paul.
Cheers. Bye.
That about wraps up our episode of Music and Time on WGXC today. I hope you enjoyed our sonic time travel trip. I couldn't have done it without Paul Drummond, one of our foremost scholars on the 13th floor elevators, and indeed a worthy guide for the expansive worlds that the elevators created on Easter Everywhere and their other records. You can read more about Paul, his books, his work, and his shop, Pleasures of Past Times, on the internet. I will be back next month on the fourth Wednesday of March at 10 a.m. Join me then for another sonic time travel trip. Don't forget to donate in the meantime to WGXC to keep this show and other shows like it going. Wavefarm.org/donate. Thanks for your support and thanks for listening.